floor over you.
Walking the floor.
I'm walking the floor.
Walking the floor over you.
Hola, señores and señoritas. This is Chris Shiflett, and you are listening to Walking the Floor, and we are back from the holiday hiatus. So happy, happy new year. Hope you had a great break. Hope you did something fun. Hope you had a wonderful Christmas and all that jazz. And I hope you're ready to get back into the nitty gritty of podcasting, baby, because we're back. And we got a bunch of good interviews coming out over the next several weeks. I realized yesterday I still haven't posted my Delbert McClinton interview. Jesus, I thought I posted that months ago. I was kind of going through the what do I have in the can kind of thing the other day, and I got that one. I just interviewed Marcus King a couple days ago, guitar ripper Marcus King. I interviewed my buddy Luke Dick, Nashville songwriter and now documentary filmmaker. And of course, today's interview with Robert O'Keefe is nothing short of amazing, people. So, you know, come on, we're back. I think I don't want to labor the point, but we are back. Okay, a little bit of news. It got announced yesterday, I think, that the Beach Life Festival at the beginning of May down in Redondo Beach, I am playing it on the acoustic stage. It's going to be me and an acoustic guitar, no band. You can come throw Rotten Tomatoes or whatever you do at those sensitive acoustic shows. I'm playing, it's multi-day, but I'm playing on May 2nd, and I play early at 1:15, so get your tickets now. Get out there early. Come support the sensitive acoustic stage at the Beach Life Festival in Redondo Beach. Okay, let's pay a couple of bills. Did you know Sounds.com has been around since 1996? If not, I mean, 1996, that's really not that long ago. For me, I'm old, I'm almost 50, but for you kids listening, 1996, man. It all started way back when as a small retail shop and has since grown to become one of the biggest and bestest online musical instrument retailers on earth. And of course, Sound staff are all musicians. So if you prefer a call, they know the gear and they speak the language of gig. Sounds.com. Go buy something today. All right, let's get to the interview. Robert Earl Keen. Okay, it's not every day I get to interview a guest of this caliber. Robert Earl Keen, heavy-duty Texas songsmith with a long, storied career. Many of those stories he tells right here in this interview. And, of course, his life and work are peppered with, other legends of the genre like Lyle Lovett, Steve Earle, Nancy Griffith. He tells a bunch of great stories about all those folks. And of course, we get into the nitty-gritty details of how he approaches songwriting and what he does and where he goes and how he finds inspiration, all that kind of great stuff. And just to put a little context to this, so this is the last interview that I did when I was out at Americana Fest last fall. And it had been a crazy week, as you can understand. I was kind of running on fumes. I was burnt, which was great because I was a little nervous going into this for a couple reasons. First off, it's Robert Earl Keen, man. I didn't want to screw this up. And we were doing it in front of a live audience, which was a lot of fun. This was a rowdy audience at that. And we did this cool thing where, in case you don't know, he has his own podcast. So we did like a joint podcast session where, first off, he interviewed me. And he's posting that today. So when you're done with this interview, make sure you go find the Americana podcast, the 51st State, on iTunes or Spotify or wherever you stream or download your podcast. They're putting my interview, or his interview with me, up today. And then we took a little break and came back on stage, and I interviewed him. And it just could not have been more fun. It was so great. I really like these live interviews. I want to do more of this. Anywho, this is Robert Earl Keen on Walking the Floor.
He's doing all he can not to give in to the city, and he always takes a rent late so long as I got his car.
Is this all the same people that were just in here? Okay, okay. Because I was gonna feel that. Yeah, I'm gonna feel silly introducing this man because you know who I'm sitting here with. But I will say this is my final. Yes. Well, thank you. Not only does she know how to pronounce Aaron's last name, but she knows your name, Robert Earl Keen, Nashville. Give it up. All right. Well, now you're in the hot seat, buddy. How do you like doing the podcast? I got to tell you, you're really good at it.
Thank you.
I'm no expert, but you asked great questions. That was really fun.
Thank you. I love doing the podcast for the same reason that you talked about earlier. I've been, rolling around in a bus all the time. You're pretty isolated. So
yeah.
I just feel like, and sometimes you think, oh, man, I know everything. And then you realize you step out and all of a sudden it's a 2019, you go, shit, I've been in here since 2009, and you don't know anything,
right?
And so it's been a great experience and a lesson to, you know, find all the music and listen to the music and kind of get involved with that in a different way than just playing.
How often do you post an episode?
Once a month. Now, we're not as brave as you are.
I had a year that I was doing once a week.
Whoa.
And I was like, I don't want to be a full-time podcaster. This is my hobby, man.
Yeah, yeah. I understand. I mean, it takes a lot of work, huh?
It does. Yeah. We kind of touched on this a little bit when we were just talking, but doing the interviews now, does that make you more sympathetic or less sympathetic to journalists interviewing you?
Oh, there's a good question. How many journalists are here? I would have to be honest, I'd say less sympathetic.
Right.
I realize that there's so much to it and that you almost can't do enough as far as like researching someone or listening to their music, and when they ask those kind of questions, those innocuous questions like you were talking about, does the music come first or is it lunch, you know, that sort of thing.
Yeah.
I go, okay, yeah, all right, let me just go ahead and click into my automatic answer.
Right. Well, on that note, I have to ask one obvious question.
Mm-hmm.
What does the mythical phrase, Texas songwriter, mean to you?
Well, I would have to say, and I'm not blowing smoke up your ass here, but I would have to say it would kind of start with Ernest Tubb and Walking the Floor and moving on up through there, and that like Ernest was from Texas and started out really there, and then like all the things that came together. Even in the 60s, there were quite a few people that moved up to Nashville and got into the Nashville scene, and you know, the biggest one being Willie Nelson. But there's so much, you know, Sonny Throckmorton and the guy that's from Beaumont that wrote all the hits in the 80s and the 90s. I forgot his name. I can't call his name right now. But anyway, there were so many of those people that wrote great songs. And so when you say, you know, Texas singer-songwriter, I'd have to say it's a tradition, and it's an ongoing path.
Well, it's interesting, and I'm fascinated. I've interviewed a lot of Texas musicians, mm-hmm. Texas artists, and I've always been fascinated by the fact that Texas is really like the only state that has a sort of insular like a scene, almost like a circuit, you know what I mean? Where there are artists that can exist just within that and like are huge mm-hmm. and make a living, you mm-hmm. know what I mean? Like you don't see people driving around with I Heart Arizona Music stickers on their car, you know what I mean? There's nowhere else where that exists. Like why did that develop there, do you think?
I want to say,
because it's not like it's necessarily easy geographically, you know.
No,
what I mean?
No,
it's pretty spread out.
800 miles from Beaumont to El Paso,
right?
So I want to go with the fact that it started back somewhere before Bob Wills, with all the music being played, but it being played in dance halls and people playing all those dance halls. For instance, in the 70s, particularly in the late 60s and the 70s into the 80s, there was a huge dance hall circuit. For instance, George Strait came from that circuit,
right.
And they played dances. I mean, from you know, maybe Wednesday night all the way through Sunday night, and they just went around to these all these different halls, every place from the hall in LaGrange to Hallettsville, out to Midland, to all those towns in West Texas, and you know, ran around in some old raggedy buses or station wagons and just set up their stuff. A lot of times they carried their own PA system,
right,
and they played all of those places. And those places really no longer exist, except for with the exception of like Floor's Country Store or maybe Green Hall.
Yeah.
But that created that whole idea that we don't have to go outside the state of Texas and we can just play, you know, Wednesday through Sunday night and make a living.
And that continues today. Like, mm-hmm. that still exists, even mm-hmm. with, like, the red dirt
right.
world. And those guys aren't driving around in junky old buses.
They
have brand new Prevost or whatever.
Yeah, you know? No, no. Yeah. With the trailer and with a guy in a van behind them, you know, right. carrying all the stuff. So, no, it's a full-blown circuit of its own, and people seriously make, you know, a really good living, and there's a whole music scene. There's a Texas music chart, and
right.
there's you know, festivals just based on Texas music.
Sure. At this point in your life and, you know, recording career and all that sort of thing, what's like a typical day in the life like for you? Because I have, you know, my fantasy version of that. Like, you're on a porch somewhere. You know, maybe Jerry, Jeff Walker, and Willie are with you. The ghost of Guy Clark and Townes Van Zandt are staring down proudly. Is that about right? We're just passing the guitar around, writing songs.
No, I want to say I kind of followed that idea, that fantasy for years. I lived in Austin, Texas in the early 80s, and I always was waiting for Willie to, you know, show up at one of my shows or just hang around one of the bars that I hung around at. And, you know, I kind of after a while, I thought, well, I guess he doesn't do that, you know.
Because yeah. he's out on Maui or whatever.
Yeah, right. Yeah. He's out on Maui. And so finally, I just, you know, then I just kind of decided, well, you just kind of get along by yourself. But I get together with some people, but in general, my life is these days, it's about touring,
right?
And it's about my home life, being at home with my family, and in between, I wash laundry.
That sounds exactly like my life, man. That's great. Yeah, right. Keeps you on your feet.
Yeah, right? keeps you on your toes. So I do have, Chris, I do have a place where I write that's out in the country, and it's this building that I built back in the late 90s, and it's about, I don't know, 600 square feet. Less than 500 square feet, and it's on the side of a hill. It has this great view, and it's called my wife named it this. It's called the Scriptorium, and and I have a whole lot of books in there, and I have a bunch of guitars and a couple of mandolins, and when I really want to sit down to write and get some solitude, I, you know, leave my phone at home, and if anybody ever has to talk to me, they have to come out and find me, and so. I write in the scriptorium, and occasionally I have somebody come out and, you know, write a song with me, but most of the time that's by myself.
Well, I warned you this is coming, and since we're talking about that, can we get into the weeds with your actual songwriting process?
Like,
because,
sure.
you know, you're thought of as, you know, you're one of those guys, mm-hmm. like a songwriter,
right.
you know, mm-hmm. well-respected songsmith.
Right.
So what do you do? I know for me, I always keep a little journal with me. I jot stuff down mm-hmm. if a line pops into my head, and then at some point I have to go back and reread that stuff and see if anything jumps out, and then I kind of put it together. But like, what is your actual, like, I'm going to sit down and write a song process?
Well, I need a certain amount of solitude. So either I go out to the scriptorium or I got a music room in my house, and I, you know, I sit there and I really strum the guitar, and I, you know, play a, you know, just kind of hum a melody, and then Somehow, most of my songs are very visual, so I think in terms of like setting first, and I just kind of create the setting. Like we were talking about the song Marf on My Mind, and I've been out to Marfa quite a bit, so if I were to write a song like that, you know, my thought would be just kind of strum something that kind of feels Marfa-esque, you know?
Right.
And then I just sort of kind of let the words sort of come together at that time, and once I get the idea going, then I try to shape it up as a song in that, like, you know, does this have a chorus? Does this have a bridge? You know, how many times do I want to repeat this particular line, or how do I want these words actually to fit together? I'm pretty big on fitting words together that sound good together.
Right.
And so, I you know, over the years I've put together just, you know, like almost like a book of how to put together a song, and I use just all those different things to make up a song.
And when you're writing, are you drawing? I know you went to college, mm-hmm. for studying for an English degree. Are you mm-hmm. are you drawing on that skill set? Like, do you apply that to your song? Because, and the reason I ask is because years ago I took a songwriting workshop, just on a lark, and I realized that what it really was a creative writing workshop geared to songwriting. Mm-hmm. And then I went and took a couple of creative writing classes, mm-hmm. just separately, because I just thought, oh, this will help me, mm-hmm. you know, do exactly what you're talking about, like really be able to translate visualizing a place and time in a story and getting it down on paper. Like, do you sort of apply those same skills?
Mm-hmm. As far as like what I learned in school, I think I borrow from those years that I was in college studying English even more than I would admit to. And I want to, you know, say that that's in terms of, like, a lot of the courses I took were in poetry. So, so how do you get this sort of abstract idea and then follow the colors and the ideas through that and connect these different kind of stream of consciousness things until you get to something that actually pays off, you know, right. That says this is what this is all about. I don't have to say in every line this is what this is about.
Right.
I have to put all those things together until that notion just becomes the point of the whole piece. And I learned there's a lot of that in poetry, because
right.
Poetry starts, particularly today in poetry, modern poetry, where they just take all kinds of crazy stream of consciousness ideas and keep moving towards this one payoff. It's kind of like telling a really abstract joke or
right.
something until right. you get, you know, it's going to have a punchline in the
like
end.
Where is this going?
Yeah,
until
where
all
is
of a
this
sudden
going?
You go,
yeah,
oh,
there's
the
punchline. Yeah,
right.
Yeah.
I read a really good quote of yours mm-hmm. that I wanted to ask you about, which was, I feel lucky enough to write songs and have people request the songs I write. Why would I want to turn my back on that? And I was thinking of that in context of your song, The Road Goes On Forever.
Mm-hmm.
Like, is that song to you, I mean, obviously everybody knows that. So that's mm-hmm. like one of those songs that just had legs and mm-hmm. it's been covered by a million people and mm-hmm. people have had hits with it mm-hmm. and all that thing. Do you view that song as like a blessing or a curse? Because I know for some people, mm-hmm. they're like, fuck that song. I don't mean artists that have a song that it permeates culture in that way.
Mm-hmm. I love that song.
Great.
And I'll play it, you know, at the drop of the hat. There are places where I feel like maybe the band's a little worn out with it. I had a band member one time. I had a guy, a bus driver, Bill, George Strait's bus driver, told me this story. He said, I saw your buddy Duckworth the other day. I said, yeah, what did he say? He said, you know, I asked him why he quit the band. And I said, was it all the traveling? And Duckworth said, no, it was the music. And I don't want to wear out the guy. So occasionally, you know, like... I'm aware people are, you know, come to that show. Some of them just might just come to that show, just my show, to just to hear that song. You
well,
know,
that's the thing, and it made me think about like at. I always assumed everybody that comes to our shows is like, you know, the biggest Foo Fighter fan in the world or whatever. But Dave Live, our singer, will go, you know, how many people have seen the Foo Fighters perform? People raise their hand. How many haven't seen us before? And it's always like three times as many people that have never been there. And so it makes it, I've changed my thinking on that, where I think that most people that come out to like any show are just kind of casual music fans.
Right.
They know a couple of songs. Yeah. They don't know the name of the bass player or whatever. You know what I mean? It's just like that kind of, that's just what we did that night. It was fun kind of thing. And so, you know, I figure it's probably the same for everybody. I don't know. And I don't, you know, I don't know if that affects how you, you know, how you put your set together.
Well, I do occasionally leave the song out, and my best story about that was one time we played in Lubbock, and Lubbock, Texas, we it was late, you know, and I had a long time like dealing with you know, cause some of the loadout, and I was the last one out of the building, and when I walked out of the building, there was truly this cowboy dude, I mean, with like the perfect hat and the great boots and everything, the Wrangler jeans, and he had one leg propped up against the building, and he's like smoking a cigarette, and he looks up at me, and he goes, and I had not done The Road Goes On Forever, and he looks at me and goes, I guess the party ended.
He'd been waiting all night to get that one out. Jesus. When you wrote that song, did you know that you had something special?
I did not know. I didn't. I wrote that song. I was making a record called West Textures, and I was working with this great producer, Jim Rooney, who did a lot of stuff in Nashville and worked with a lot of great people. And I begged and borrowed and stole to get, you know, Jim to even listen to me. So he made a record, a live record with me, and then he agreed to make this record, West Textures, with me. And so we sat down, and he was listening to the songs. I played all the songs for him. He said, well, those are pretty good, but I just don't think you have an anchor song. You know, I said, this isn't a mall, dude. I mean, it's like, it's a record. And he said,
you need your Macy's song.
Yeah, no, my Macy's song. And so I said, well, he said, we'll just postpone the record. I said, look, I literally spent my last dollar to get here. And this is in Nashville. So I'd driven up from Texas. And I said, I don't have any choice. Jim, you got to give me a break. You got to let me at least. I have a song that I have a few verses of. And I think that, you know, you'd like it if, let me finish that song and I'll bring it to you on Sunday. And so I sat in my friend Robin Beresford's backyard on Saturday, and I finished the song, and I said, Jim, I got the song ready, and he said, come over tomorrow morning. So I went over there Sunday morning, and I played the three verses that I already had, and he said, that's the song right there. I said, well, you could have saved me a lot of time, because I had these three verses.
Right.
There's the rest of the song. And he said, well, okay, if you want to play it, that's fine. But I said, okay. But, you know, he heard it. I didn't hear it. I just thought it was good and it was okay, you know. So
whose version of it is your favorite?
Joe Ely's version.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Was that the one that kind of put it on the map?
I don't know. Joe got a lot of mileage out of the song, and it was just a great version. It was just some great playing, and Joe is such a great interpreter of. I mean, he writes great songs, but he's a great interpreter of other people's songs. So when he plays something like he did Dave Allen's Every Night About This Time, it's just a knockout. You know, just a killer. So so when he did that, then I thought the song was great.
Right.
Yeah.
I have to ask, because I'm a guitar player, who plays the guitar solo on the live version? The most well-known live version.
The one that I have?
Yeah. Who's playing lead guitar on that?
Rich Brotherton. Rich Brotherton was my guitar player for 24 years. So We played in a band for a long time. So he's not the one who left because of the music. He left for other reasons. But he was the one who played the guitar solo.
We touched on it a little bit a minute ago with Red Dirt, and I've seen you get lumped in with the Red Dirt scene. Uh-huh. And I've asked like probably every Texas musician I've interviewed, but what exactly is Red Dirt? Is that just a label out of geographical location? Because there are a lot of different things that are called Red Dirt don't sound like the same thing to me.
Right.
Like you don't sound like Casey Donahue. And
no.
And I've even seen like Mike and the Moon Pies get called Red Dirt or whatever. You know, it's like all these different sounds. So what is it?
Maybe it's something geological instead of, you know, I mean, like instead of geographic. But
because it's just, you know, Texas and Oklahoma artists.
Yeah, well, I think it first really sprung out of Oklahoma. And
but is there a sound that's part of it that is...
I would say it's a country sound, but it's a very independent country sound that seems to not it borrows from some things, but it's definitely its own sound.
Right. Mm-hmm. Where'd you grow up?
I grew up in Houston, Texas. I was born in Houston. I grew up there till I was 18, and then I went to Texas A&M. Yeah, that's right. Yeah. We have our own culture there, buddy.
Apparently, yeah.
I want to tell you, yeah, we can do all the yells here and everything.
This crowd is so... I did a couple other live podcasts this week, and this is so much rowdier. I like it. I like it. We were over in like a hotel ballroom at 10:30 in the morning. It was like real brightly lit.
Oh, boy.
This is what I was hoping for. There we go. Scream all you want.
Yeah.
Now... Now, I know you didn't start playing music and writing songs and stuff until college age, but what were you always into music? Like, what got you the music? What gave you the music bug? Was it your family or friends? What was it?
That's funny. A friend of mine sent me a picture from the Houston Coliseum in 1968 of a Cream concert. I was 12 years old and I was at that concert.
Really?
Yeah. He said, "Was this the concert you were at?" I said, It was the concert that I was at. So, growing up in Houston, I was, you know, that era rock fan, you know, the Cream and the Beatles and, you know, Deep Purple, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And then somewhere, when I was 14, I think 14, do you find 14 as being particularly significant year for people to
it was for me.
Yeah, gravitate that was the music. Year, it's a funny thing.
Yeah, that was the year that I knew that I wanted to be a musician, like for real.
Right.
Yeah. That summer.
So I think I was about 14, and I started listening to swing music, and particularly Western swing, Spade Cooley, Bob Wills, and that thing. And then I kind of moved into country and. All things country, which included bluegrass and string band stuff and that sort of thing. By the time I went to college, I was just totally all into like just country and bluegrass. And
how did you, how did you find Western swing in the, like, what did your Deep Purple listening friends think about that? Was there still a scene for that in Texas?
Absolutely.
Early
70s. And, right. And there was a kind of a division there because there was like what you would call, the hippies, right, and then the kickers, right. So you kind of be one or the other, but especially in Houston, Texas, you know. And then there was a significant group of people that like dressed up like cowboys and wore hats and all that business. And then there were a significant group of people that like were totally into Cream and that sort of thing. And they didn't really mix that much. And I just sort of jumped ship on one and went to the other. And probably because I rode horses when I was a kid, and I started going to, like, when I was in junior high school, I started going to these, they have this thing called this trail ride where you ride horses from about 100 miles out of Houston into Houston.
Jeez.
And that starts the rodeo every year. So I would do that every year. And that particular, just being in that culture and that whole living with that and that, the country music and the horse riding and the cowboy thing, I just kind of shifted.
So why did you start playing then in college?
I started playing because I was not a really, I was a lousy student and I was bored and I was scared and I wanted to, you know, grab onto something that I, you know, felt like I could, you know, that I could control. And right. My sister had an old Alvarez classical guitar that was hanging in a closet and I pulled it out, shined it up, put some strings on it, got a book that's called The 10 Greatest Country Songs Ever Written, and I learned 9 of them. One of them was called The Happiest Girl in the Whole USA, so I skipped that one, right? I didn't think
that would have been the one that would have gotten you the checks, man.
Yeah, I know. It would have worked for me if I would have been... I wasn't that much of a thinker, Chris. You know, I was just really like, there's a D chord, there's a C chord. Okay, great. So I learned those songs. And then one of those deals like you do in school or when you're, you know, when you get away is you start, you know, in playing music, you start finding other people that do that, you know, and play. So I started playing with a lot of people then.
And how did that transition to getting up on stage and doing it in front of people that way?
I had a little band called the Front Porch Band that we created. It was a guy named Ronnie West that played the fiddle and my friend Duckworth that played the fiddle and the mandolin and I played the guitar. And we were called the Front Porch Boys, and that was because we always hung out on this front porch that Lyle and I wrote this song about. And we played spaghetti suppers and downtown on the Sunday afternoon at the plaza and some little rodeo out in Madison, Texas, or something like that. So just anything that, you know, that we could find that was just about playing. And as far as like that went, is I always thought it was like the playing, you know, playing the guitar, that interest. Because, you know, when I first learned a D chord, I sat there for about 12 hours straight playing a D chord. Like, I just loved it so much. I love it. So it's just, and then you know, putting together a song and writing a song and then getting on stage. So, you know, I'd written a couple of songs, but I'd never been on stage. And when I got on stage, then I was totally hooked, you know. Mm. That was like, I can do this.
And how long did it take before you were... you know, recording and putting out records?
Oh, all the way through college, I never did. I never even thought about it. I heard some recordings and was interested in all that. But I finished school and I moved to Austin and got a job and then started trying to figure out how to record. They had a great radio station in Austin, Texas called KUT. It's a public radio station.
Sure.
It's also managed by the university there. And they had a show on Saturday morning called Folkways, and it was a 4-hour show. And that particular show, I'd listen to every Saturday morning, and I, you know, it got in my head that then they played local stuff as well. They played everything, but they played local stuff, and I thought, I really want to be on KUT. I really want to be on Folkways. So that's how I got started thinking about doing a record. And I was talking to my friend Lyle, and Lyle came by one day and said, "Hey, I got something for you." And he handed me this book called How to Make and Sell Your Own Record. And I said, "This is exactly what I was looking for." I pretty much did what the book said, and I made a record.
That's so funny. I remember somebody giving me a book called Everything You Ever Wanted to Know About the Music Industry.
Uh-huh.
Something that around the same time in my life.
Right.
I read that thing too. Like,
yeah.
Oh, damn. This is really complicated.
And I'm really
getting
behind.
Ripped off. So is that how you put out your first record? You self-released it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, put it out. I was working with a guy that played the dobro at the time, and he had a little, it was actually a educational record label, and we just put it out on his label.
Well, so I know somewhere in all that you moved to Nashville.
Mm-hmm.
Eventually, like, did you move up here trying to make it in like the mainstream country world or as a songwriter? What was going on? Like, where were you at in your career at that point?
I was playing around Austin and really kind of thinking that I'd done about as much as I could, you know, as far as like really, you know, if I stayed there, I'd just be kind of playing the same old places everybody plays in Austin. And I ran into Steve Earle, okay, and not always your best advisor, but still. still a fun guy.
Sure.
And a smart guy.
Lively.
Right? Yeah, yeah. And Steve said, man, you got to get out of here. You're going to turn into Rich Minus. And Rich Minus was this guy that went around, and he was about 50 at the time, and he went around all these little crappy joints all the time and played like the same three songs that he'd written. And one of them, Willie Nelson had cut on a record, right?
Oh,
so,
wow.
So that was Rich's big deal, was like, he just, you know, played the three songs over right, and over. Yeah. And, you know, Steve has this amazing ability to, like, sort of grab all kinds of information out of the air. I don't know how he does it because he talks a lot, too. So, like, but he knows a ton of stuff. Right.
Yeah.
I mean, and he goes, if you stay here, you're going to turn into Rich Minus. So I went, ah! No, I don't want to be Rich Minus.
Right.
I don't. And so I said, "Well, what do I do, Steve?" He said, "You got to move up to Nashville and suffer." And I said, "Okay, that sounds good to me. I'd love to suffer." You know. And I left like this incredible, like, you know, like Corona commercial world of like hanging out with my buddies and drinking beer and doing anything I wanted to do all the time, not having any money, but still having a great time.
Sure.
And then moved up to, you know, hey, yeah, I'm going to suffer. So I came up here and I suffered.
Did you jump into like getting a publishing deal and doing like, you know, writing with a couple other people every day, appointments? And were you doing that whole thing?
I heard someone say that I couldn't have gotten through a door if it was made of paper one time, right? and at the time, you know, my friends were Steve and Lyle and Nancy Griffith, and they were all really blowing up, you know.
Yeah.
So I
yeah.
thought, well, you know, something's gonna happen. And
sure.
I really went around and, you know, and could not, like, you know, catch a meeting and stuff. I mean, I didn't go do anything like drag my guitar around and beat on people's door or borrow somebody's helicopter and fly to Johnny Cash's house, you know, but I did, you know.
I'm surprised that nobody ever did that again.
It
worked
know.
So well the first time.
Yeah, well, why not? It's about time,
yeah.
I think. So whoever's listening, you know, charge up that helicopter. Anyway, so I worked a jillion different jobs here, and I got married at the time, and probably the highlight really is my wife and I ran Hat Show Print for a year while I was here, and that was a really great experience because I kind of got to learn how to do letterpress printing and all that sort of thing.
Do you have like an incredible collection of vintage Johnny Cash posters now?
No, I don't. Actually, what happened was like at the time, Hatch was so unknown and such uncared for that people were pilfering stuff out of there all the time.
Mm.
And there's stuff all over Nashville that there are wood blocks and wood prints and stuff. And those things that no one ever paid for, they walked out of there with them, you know? And I really, like, I knew this, and I thought, you know, I would love to take this, and
right.
I'd love to throw this in the back of my car, but I just couldn't do it, because I just thought, you know, like, well, I mean, this is a venerable establishment, and it's, you know, my 1889, you know? And
you're way too honest for the music business,
well,
sir.
I don't know about that, but I mean... but that lesson there was, you know, worth the time. But also, Chris, I'd say this is like the friendships that I made up here. I was here 22 months. So the friendships I made here have lasted me all this time, and all of them have really helped me over the years. And had I not done that, had I not had some of those experiences and learned about the music business, like your book you're talking about.
Right.
Had I not known about that, I'd be that same old guy down in Austin going, well, what do you think about people stealing your publishing?
Yeah.
You know, I mean,
right.
it doesn't happen, dumbass, unless
right.
you let it happen.
Right.
That's what,
right.
you know? So,
yeah.
So I want to say that, like, you know, there's a certain thing going on here. It's charming. It's the industry. It's happening like every day.
Well, you've been, you know, you've self-released records, you've been on major labels. What version of the music industry is the most comfortable space for you?
Well,
like, how do you put out your records now? Do you have your own label?
No. I put out, I did my own label thing at one time. I created a record company back in the 90s with John Kuntz, who runs Waterloo Records, and another guy, and we created this record company called Waterloo Records, and we made you know, two or three records during the time I was there, and I realized, well, I don't want to be in the record business, right? So I sold my part out to those guys, and I moved on. So I've always worked with the record company. I you know, regardless of, you know, the pros and cons about the record companies, they know what they're doing in that world. And, sure, you know, they don't know how to get on stage and play a song or entertain people, but they and I know how to do that. I don't know how to do what they do. So I always rely on a record company.
So was the live record that you did, was that the record that kind of put you on? I know you've done a bunch of live records, but Number Two Live Dinner, was that the one? Like, I'm trying to get the timeline.
That was, yeah, did, that was about 95.
Okay,
yeah.
So you had gone back to Texas after the Nashville experiment.
Yeah, right, right.
And that was the one that was the one that kind of, like, you know.
That
you
did, and it was a surprise because I want to say it's definitely not my favorite record, and it was a record at the time I thought the band was pretty cool, and I really just wanted to record the band and archive that. Yeah. And so I got a deal at that time with Arista Records, and it was like, you know, I got a major label deal, you know, go ahead and buy the mansion and call up those people that fix your mansion on DIY. And and I got this, but I loved Barry Poss with Sugar Hill Records, and I made five records with him, and I really hated to, like, leave Barry, because and Sugar Hill's in it was at the time in Durham, North Carolina. So I felt bad about that. So I took this live record, and I said, "Listen, I'm going to end up doing some record on Arista here." So I thought, you know, and I hate to leave you, but I thought I'd leave this as a parting gift, and you do whatever you want to with it. So he put it out, and it was truly one of those kind of grassroots thing, because it's warts and all, you know, it's rough, and it got picked up by, I don't know, mainly like the college kids at the time, and they were really like they just listened to it over and over, and you could go on college campuses and hear it in all the dorms coming out of the dorm rooms.
Back when college radio was like a strong component of this whole thing.
When it was like, almost like, you know, the mover and the shaker of this kind of business, you know? Yeah. And another, you know, huge surprise to me. I was like, you know, the record's okay. It's cool songs, whatever.
Was Flora's Country Store a place that did you have history with? Like, had you played there a million times over the years?
I had.
For people that don't know what that place is, that's like one of the last of the dance hall.
It's an outdoor deal, and it's right outside of San Antonio in a town called Helotes, Texas, and it's been there 77 years now. And like their premier person that plays there year after year is Willie Nelson. And if you listen to the record Shotgun Willie, he has a verse about John T. Flores, right? John T. Flores. And so it's one of those, like I said earlier, it's truly one of those dance hall kind of records. And up through about the mid 90s, they still just basically did dance music, country dance music. People would come out and dance, right? And then they started morphing into, you know, some Nashville acts that would just come out and people would watch.
Yeah.
And I was actually the first, like, regional act that they ever booked there as, like, and I had to beg and, you know, please let me play. And so they gave me a Sunday afternoon. They had a family afternoon on Sunday afternoon where they'd have like a bluegrass band and people just sit around and eat chicken. And they decided that, you know, okay, well, we'll let you have the Sunday. We'll knock off our family day and you can have the Sunday. And I went there and I had 1,500 people show up and they freaked out. And from then on, I was like, you know, I could do that. So that was the reason. And so like 4 years later, that's when I did the live at Forest Country Store.
I've actually recently played there for the first and only time I've ever played there. Yeah. And it was I just had an open night on a run of shows. Uh-huh. that I was dealing with Paul Cawthon, and I was just down there playing acoustic guitar, no band, and I wound up jumping on Dale Watson's gig there.
Nice.
And which was great, but I quickly learned that is not a venue you want to be up there playing an acoustic guitar with a bunch of songs nobody's ever heard. Because there is nothing to dance to there. That was a very interesting night, but a legendary venue. So cool.
No, and it's held on, and it's been kind of surrounded by, you know, urban sprawl at this point. At the time that was made, Helotes was totally separate from San Antonio, but it's been usurped by the San Antonio, whatever that is.
Right. Yeah. So at that point, did you already have did you know that you had this sort of groundswell fan base developing down there? Like, was it a surprise to you? They were surprised 1,500 people showed up, but were you?
No, I wasn't. Right. That was part of my pitch, was like, this is happening, pay attention, and here's how that really came about. I had a booking agent at the time. Her name is Denise Stiff. She went on to manage Alison Krauss for 21 years, and Denise is almost my favorite person in the world of management. I mean, she was truly smart with money, and she was a real idea person. And so she and I created this thing called the World Tour of San Antonio, and it's and it started on Tuesday night, and it ended on Sunday afternoon. And we played all the little crummy joints all around San Antonio, but you got a passport, and if you did all of the passport, if you did every show like that, you won like a T-shirt and like, you know, a meet and greet instead of the 405, and and an hour just to hang out and play songs together and stuff. One of those kind of like value add things.
Yeah.
So the last one was at Flores Country Store, and that's how we were able to talk this guy into it, because we said, this is going to be the last one. It'll be the biggest one.
Well, I bet they're happy that they let you play there now.
Oh, yeah.
Give it up for Robert Earl Keane. Thank you, sir.
Thank
you. That was fantastic.
I had a blast time. Yeah.
Are you going to play some songs now?
Yeah, I can play. Yeah. Okay, just so I don't have any cowboys wanting to tell me about the party. She was a waitress, the only joint in town. She had a reputation as a girl who'd been around. I made shit after midnight, brand new pack of cigs, a fresh one hanging from her lips, a beer between her legs. She'd ride down to the river and meet with all her friends. The road goes on forever, the party never ends. Sonny was a loner, older than the rest. He was going in the Navy, he couldn't pass the test. So he hung around town, sold a little pot. The law guy went to Sonny, one day got caught. But he was back in business, they set him free again. The road goes on forever, the party never ends. Sonny's playing 8-ball at the joint where Sherry works, and some drunken out of towner put his hand up Sherry's skirt. Sonny took his pool cue light and drunk out on the floor, stopped a dollar in a tip jar, walked on out the door. She's running right behind him, reaching for his hand. The road goes on forever, the party never ends. They jumped to his pickup, Sonny jammed her down in gear. Sonny looked at Sherry, let's get on out of here. The stars were high above them, the moon was in the east, the sun was setting on them. They reached Miami Beach, they got a motel by the water, the Port of Bombay gin. The road goes on forever, the party never ends. They soon ran out of money, but Sonny knew a man. He knew some Cuban refugees, scouting contraband. Sonny met the Cubans at a house just off the road with a briefcase full of money, a pistol in his booth, cards on the table. The law came busting in, the road goes on forever, the party never ends. The Cubans grabbed the goodies, Sonny grabbed the jack. He broke a bathroom window, he climbed on out the back. Sherry drove the pickup to the alley on the side. Well, old man Tackle Sonny was reading him his rights. She stepped into the alley with a single shot, 410. The road goes on forever, the party never ends. They left the lawman lying, meaning it away. In the motel before the break of day, Sonny gave her all the money, he blew a little kiss. If they asked you how this happened, I forced you to this. She watched him as his taillights disappeared around a bend. The road goes on forever, the party never ends. It's Main Street after midnight, just like it was before. 21 months later at the local grocery store, she buys a paper, a cold six-pack of beer. The headlines read that Sonny is going to the chair. She pulls back on a Main Street in her new Mercedes Benz. The road goes on forever and the party never ends. Thanks. Thanks to Chris. Thanks to Endo and everybody here.
Yes, yes, yes. That was Robert Earl Keen right here on Walking the Floor. As always, make sure you get on over to walkingthefloor.com. I'm going to post some links up there so you can see exactly what Robert Earl Keen is up to right this very moment. And now that you're done with this episode, go find the Americana podcast, the 51st state, where you can listen right now to Robert Earl Keen interview me. So it's like the, you know, it's the companion piece to what you've just listened to. Okay, that's it for this week. We'll be back in 2 weeks with my man Marcus King. Tune in then. Adios, amigo!
With lots of cheese and onions and a guacamole salad, you can get them at the La Salle Hotel in old downtown, with iced tea and a waitress who will smile every time.